This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in Food podcast, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Tippin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Rebecca Sharpless about the new edition of 200 Years of Charleston Cooking, published by University of South Carolina Press, to which she supplied a new critical introduction. Rebecca Sharpless is professor of history at Texas Christian University. She's author of Fertile Ground, Narrow Choices, Women on Texas Cotton Farms, and Cooking in Other Women's Kitchens, Domestic Workers in the South, 1865 to 1960. Welcome to the podcast, Rebecca. It is a pleasure to be speaking to you.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, start by telling us a little about your academic and professional backgrounds. How did you get interested in writing about food and especially women's food work?
Well, I'm tempted to say that when you talk about women that you're talking about, when you talk about food work that you're talking about women, but we'll set that aside for a minute. I got interested in food when I was working on my dissertation that became my first book. I wrote about women on cotton farms in Central Texas. And a long backstory on that, but the bottom line is that I covered the period 1900 to 1940. And when I was working on that in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there were still a lot of women around who had lived through that period. It's hard to believe that was 30 years ago and they're all dead now, but I did a lot of oral history interviews with women who had either grown up or actually were farm wives on these cotton farms in Central Texas. And the detail that they could talk about food was absolutely remarkable. The foods weren't fancy. By and large, there were some wealthy people in the region, but a lot of people lived on a basic diet that included a whole lot of cornbread. And if they could get white bread or light bread, as they called it, it was considered a real treat. Lots and lots of biscuits, lots and lots of what they called bacon or side meat. But a lot of detail and a lot of interest in food. And I thought, well, gosh, there's something here. So I decided that I was going to do my second book on something about Southern women and food. I'm a Southern Americanist by training. And so I was going to do how women worked on how women made money through food. And I was going to have various chapters, and it was going to include domestic work. And one day I was talking to David Perry, my editor at the University of North Carolina Press, and he says, you know, if you can do that domestic worker piece, you will have done something. And I said, well, okay. So away went the caterers, away went the cookbook writers, away went everybody except the domestic workers. And that's where my second book came from. Along the line, however, I have thought a lot about the nature of cookbooks as historical sources, as you have, obviously.
Yes.
And I've done, you know, some writing and some thinking about exactly what kind of a text a cookbook is for a historian. And I suspect, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that's how the University of South Carolina folks found me to do this introduction.
Yes. And my second question is exactly about what you were about to describe. This is not your first cookbook project. You have a really excellent chapter in the collection, The Larder, Food Studies Methods from the American South, about a church cookbook from Waco, Texas. And I usually assign your essay cookbooks as resources for rural research in my literary cookbook class with Food Studies grad students. Yeah. So I love that question about what can we do with cookbooks as a document? So maybe talk a little bit more about that. How do cookbooks help us learn more about women in history? What role do cookbooks play in the study of history? I look at them from rhetoric and literature, but I'd love to know what you're thinking.
Cookbooks were an easy entree into food studies because they are printed and they exist.
Yes.
You know, if you walk into a library and say, "What do you have on women and food?" they're going to look at you and say, "Not much." And that will be right, except for the cookbooks. Mm-hmm. And while cookbooks are not exclusively female, they are largely female. And so they're documents and they exist. And so that's one way to get into them. And it's really fascinating. Cookbooks have been around for literally practically forever. The first cookbook in the United States, the first American cookbook in the United States was printed in the 1790s, and it was by a woman from the North. The first cookbooks in the South started in the 1820s. And in the North, in the early 19th century, there are a bunch of what, I don't know what you call them. I call them experts. They're women who made their careers writing domestic work, women like Catherine Beecher and Lydia Maria Child. They're not Southerners, but they are from the North. And for example, somebody raised the question the other day about the difference between icing and frosting. Mm. And I was not able to come up with a definitive answer, but at some point in the 1830s, Lydia Maria Child decided to call the stuff frosting, where everybody before that time that I've seen in print had called it icing. Why? I don't know. But, you know, through the writing of Lydia Maria Child, I was able to figure out, okay, that's one of the first written references to the word frosting. After the Civil War, the publication of cookbooks expands hugely. Some of them are these so-called expert cookbooks, but at this time we also get the rise of these incredible documents called community cookbooks. Mm-hmm. And a community cookbook is a project in which some, usually a group or organization, often a church, decides to publish a cookbook. And they get people in the community to contribute recipes. And they're not 100% foolproof because sometimes people donate recipes that they want you to think that mm-hmm. they're cooking as opposed to what they're actually cooking. But sometimes they really do give us a good feel for what people are actually cooking and eating in a certain area at a certain time. They can be trendy. They have a lot of issues, but they are really amazing documents. And from the 1880s through, I would say, 1960, this is astonishing outpouring that gives us this really great, great insight, as well as all the commercial cookbooks.
Yeah. One reviewer of my book said about the cookbooks that they were nice because they stood still. And I think about that as, you know, comparing to another book that was more about interviews and things that were more amorphous. But those documents that stand still and let us look at them, even though it does take, you know, a trained person to really understand what's the reality and what is aspirational, and then some guessing, some good guesswork. Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because they can be so very homely. since the rise of digitization with HathiTrust and archive.org, there are so many that are digitized and they're just there full text waiting for anybody and everybody. But at the same time, I'm working on a project right now here in North Texas, and Texas Women's University in particular and Baylor have cookbooks of which they have the only copy. So even with digitization, there are still some really rare things out there. And one of the things that I would love to put out there for your listeners is to look for these rare ones. You know, and with your grandmother's church, that cookbook comes up, take it. If you don't want it, find the library and donate it where other people can use it.
That's well
because
said.
They're really, really, they can be very rare and very important.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but every person whose grandmother has passed and who's cleaning out the house brings me their box of cookbooks to see if there's anything in it that I should know about. Cool.
Yeah, I recently had an exchange with that. I'll send you my cookbooks if you want them. No, I don't collect cookbooks. I would drown in them. Find a nice library.
Find a nice library. That's a good answer. Well, I like a good process discussion. So talk to me about how you write an introduction for a historic cookbook. What kind of research did you do? And what were your goals for writing this foreword?
One of the things I was most interested in is setting things in context for the reader at this particular junction in the life of the world. So the questions that I ask of the cookbook now might not be what somebody asked 20 years ago, and certainly not what the second introducer wrote in 1976. And let me say, this cookbook is the University of South Carolina Press made the decision to publish this cookbook. To republish it. It was originally published in 1931 by a New York publisher, and then the South Carolina Press reprinted it in 1976 with an introduction by a local woman, sort of local woman, a woman who'd grown up in Charleston and moved around the world and then come back. And I honestly don't know what led them to publish a 90th anniversary edition of it. USC Press has been very active and very, very helpful in reprinting editions of women's writing, including and maybe even particularly cookbooks. So that's kind of been one of their specialties. So all of that is to say, I got this email from the editor asking if I would do it. And of course, since I love cookbooks as you love cookbooks, I jumped at the chance to do it. So my first step, obviously, was to read what's in it. And then start analyzing it. And there are a couple of different ways to go about that. One is to look at the recipes themselves. And the other is to look at what I call, I don't know what you call it, I call it the framing material, the introductions, the head notes, the end notes, anything that sets the book in its time and place. And as it turns out, this book had quite a bit of both. It had an introduction by the editor, an introduction by the woman whose idea it was, had a note from the recipe tester at the New York newspaper. So there's already a lot going on with it. From that material, we learn that this is a cookbook of what you might almost call a double sensibility. It's about Charleston, but it is very much filtered through New York. The woman who's... Sorry, this is the kind of thing you said we would edit out.
Yep.
So Helen Woodward came to Charleston to take a vacation in the late 1920s. Now, she was, her parents were Eastern European Jewish immigrants to New York, and she was very much a New Yorker. She had had a career as an early woman in advertising. She had already written an extremely successful autobiography. But she was married to a South Carolinian. So you've got this double culture there. And so she came to Charleston on a vacation and stayed at the home. Stayed at a guest house owned by Blanche Rhett, one of those Rhetts. And they were chatting, and she said something about the recipes to Blanche Rhett. And Blanche Rhett said, "Well, you write books. Why don't you get a, you know, why don't you put together a book of our recipes, and I'll get all my friends to contribute, and we can do this." And so that's, as they tell it, how the book was formed. Mm-hmm. So a New York woman's idea in conjunction with a very well-connected, highly placed Charleston woman. And I was able to find out a fair amount about both of those women, as well as the technical editor from the New York, Letty Gay from the New York newspaper that was kind of behind the project. So who are these women? What are they about? And then I look and how this came to be. It's fascinating because Northerners have been interested in Southern recipes for a very long time. The first cookbook that I know of published in the North was about Southern cooking was like 1866. I mean, really early after the Civil War. So there's always been this Northern fascination with Southern recipes is, dare we say, exotic. And people argue that Southern cuisine is the most easily recognized regional cuisine in the United States, and I think that's probably correct. So, but a New York publisher publishing recipes from Charleston. So looking at that, looking at those, then... And then I looked at the recipe contributors, and there used to be this old joke that a woman got her name in print only when she was born, when she married, and when she died. Cookbooks have been the exception to that, mm-hmm. even though there are still some who are anonymous. But these recipes come in batches, and with Blanche Sally Rhett being so well connected, they are from the creme de la creme of Charleston society. And what they are trying to do, I argue in the introduction, is that they are trying to make, they're part of this huge wave of nostalgia for the Old South, and Charleston in particular, because when Charleston was established in 1670, it's a major seaport in the South, and when they get rice going, they have enormous wealth, and huge rice plantations staffed by hundreds of enslaved people. And so the fortunes made by the white enslavers are quite fabulous. They built amazing houses, of which you can still see a number in the Low Country. And through that Port of Charleston, they can get any food that is available in the Western Hemisphere. Mm. If you had money in Charleston, you could get it. Really, really phenomenal. And virtually all the cooking done by enslaved Africans, some of whom attained extremely high levels of culinary excellence. And but there was a civil war. And after the civil war, the rice plantations died and Charleston became a backwater. Mm-hmm. So there have been a couple of really good books written on by this, by Stephanie Yule and by Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts. But the people of Charleston determined very carefully that they were gonna capitalize on this storied past, and they were going to bring back the stories of Charleston's glory and by golly, they did it. Charleston became a tourist mecca in the early 20th century when people could travel easily there by boat or train or car. Mm. And so you start getting these influxes of tourists. And this cookbook, published in 1931, is smack in the middle of that sort of sensibility. The recipes are often attributed not even to a person, but to a specific plantation. Mm. Or they will say such and such from Guatemala Plantation. And I frankly don't know how to pronounce all these Charleston proper names. And they have their oddnesses. So any Charlestonians who happen to hear this, I'm really sorry if I butcher your names. Not from there, which, you know, I had to make sure that the cookbook author, that the editors knew, say, hey, I'm a historian. I'm from Texas. Are you sure you want me? And they said, yeah, it's okay.
Well, your introduction is especially, and rightfully, you've already kind of pointed out this, critical of the ways that the cookbook erases the contributions of enslaved people. And when it does offer credit, it's usually patronizing, pretty racist in its depictions of African-American domestic cooks. You have two beautiful sentences that I want to quote to you. You wrote that it's a book of white nostalgia, not black. And then the final words of the foreword could not be any clearer. 200 years of Charleston cooking stands as a double monument to the rich foodways of the Lowcountry and the efforts of white Charlestonians to put a pretty face on white supremacy. So talk specifically about some of those moments in the cookbook when this is most on display to you, this kind of pretty face of white supremacy.
Let me back up and say that whatever the shortcomings of the Charleston people, the most egregious language in the cookbook is not from Charlestonians. It's from the food editor in New York, who just has this. She was a native of Indiana, and she just has this idea. She falls square into every trope about magical African Americans and their cooking ability that it's possible to. And so I find that exceptionally interesting and troubling because it proves how widespread this stuff was. But now, in terms of the Charlestonians, it's an interesting question and one that I've gotten into some fairly heated discussions with professional cooks about, and that is, who owns cookery? Mm-hmm. Is it the person who actually does the labor? Is it the person who buys the ingredients? Is it the person who owns the kitchen and the stove? Where is the intellectual property and all of these things? And my take on it always is, you might find this weaselly, but it's somewhere in the middle, which is that it's a fusion. Mm-hmm. Southern cooking is very much a fusion cooking between Native American, which does not get nearly enough credit, and Anglos, who own most of the capital and provided a lot of the basis through European recipes, particularly English recipes, mm-hmm. and the African Americans, who had what they beautifully call wok presence. It was their hands who measured the salt in the palm, their hands who did the stirring, their senses that knew. And I'm sorry, I'm falling into that sort of sensory that I don't want to go there, because Lord knows an African American cook is certainly capable of the most complicated chemistry recipe in the world. I don't want to fall into that trap at all. But the person standing in front of the stove is, or in front of the fireplace, has the most physical investment with the cooking. So where does ownership of all that come down? Mm-hmm. It's incredibly, incredibly complicated. And at the base of Charleston, when you look at that incredible wealth, why was that wealth available? It was available because thousands and thousands and thousands of Africans were kidnapped from Africa, brought to South Carolina, taught white people how to raise rice, and then spent their days in the rice fields, whether it was hoeing or flooding or draining or sickling or drying or, you know, whatever. It was black people who did all that. So the entire economic basis of the antebellum South is based on African-American labor. You cannot get out of that. And of course, there's no acknowledgement of that whatsoever. Mm-hmm.
Well, and so your introduction focuses a lot on those recipe contributors who would have had less attention and credit and royalties than Rhett and Gay, who were kind of doing the writing. So start with William Dees and Sally Washington. They're named in the book. Who are they? What is their role in creating the collection of recipes? And then maybe what are some of the problems with the way the book handles them?
Okay. William Dees was, interestingly enough, a male who cooked for the Rhett family in their wonderful house on the Battery for a long time. And he was an accomplished cook. I assume that he is descended from people enslaved by the Dees, by the white Dees family, who owned quite a number, and I use the word owned advisedly, who, I don't know what the nomenclature for that is now, but they were enslaved by the Dees family. Mm-hmm. And he had some formal training, and he was a very good cook. So there are, I think, 20-odd recipes by him, and they are fairly typical Southern, but there are also some pretty up-to-date ones. There are a lot of salad recipes, a number of recipes using cream cheese, which was not very common in the South in the 20th century, early 20th century. He was a good cook. Now, Sally Washington is also very interesting. I'm not 100% sure who she was. There were several Sally Washingtons living in Charleston in the late 1920s, but I suspect that she was a woman who was living with her daughter. And her recipes are interesting. And she was Helen Woodward's cook while Woodward was in Charleston. So a short-term gig. But her recipes are more typically low country, with okra and shrimp and things like that, whereas Dees's could have been plucked, some of his could have been plucked out of the Ladies' Home Journal and probably were, because that's what a good cook does. Mm-hmm. A good cook reads other people's recipes and then incorporates those people's work into their own. At least those of us, you know, people say, are you a cook? And I say, no, I'm a recipe follower.
Yeah, so that's about right.
So you take other people's recipes and you make them your own. And I suspect that's what William Dees did. The ones that frustrate me are the ones whose names we don't know. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of references in articles that aren't in the book, and a reference or two in the book to the, quote, old colored cooks. And to cooks who gave up their recipes only reluctantly because they were their family secrets and so on. No idea who those women were. Mm-hmm. No clue. You know, I might be able to go back through the census, through the manuscript census for 50 years or so, and sometimes they'll have the word cook as the woman's profession, but a lot of times cooks did other things too. They diapered babies and they swept corners and they did all kinds of things, and so they might just be listed as servant. So it's hard to know, and those are the people, particularly the women, that I really, really wish I knew who they were and that they could get proper credit for these dishes that they cooked for their white employers. Mm-hmm.
Well, you also note some other sources for recipes from those white women of Charleston's elite families. Who are some of those biggest contributors from that class, and what are their recipes like?
Let me make sure I understand your question. Are you talking about the Charleston women of the 20th century? Or are you talking about the earlier cookbooks?
The women, the actual live women.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, there are a couple. Again, these sources may stand still, but that doesn't mean that they tell you everything that you want to know, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because you can't go back and you can't ask them questions. Okay, the largest cluster, and again, I may be mispronouncing the names, but the Hurlston-Simons family has a large group of recipes. And the thing that is unknown is that Elizabeth Hurlston, who lived for most of the 19th century, she was born in 1801 and died in 1890, had a manuscript, a handwritten manuscript of recipes. And, you know, don't we wish we had that manuscript?
Mm-hmm.
Don't we wish we knew where it was? And she handed it down to her niece, and then her niece handed it down to her daughter. And so a lot of the recipes, some of the recipes have Elizabeth's name. Some of them have the name of the plantation, which is Bossis, I'm not sure,
mm-hmm.
B-O-S-S-I-S. And so there are 70 recipes in the cookbook from that cluster of family, but I don't know how many of them are from Elizabeth's manuscript, and I don't know how many of them came in because the nieces read Ladies' Home Journal. They brought in recipes from the outside. And then the other cluster is the Sally family, of which Blanche Sally Rhett, the editor, was a member, and they were really remarkable. They were not from Charleston. She married into the cream of Charleston, and the Rhetts are their own thing. But they were actually from the upcountry. And there were 12 children, 10 girls, and one of them, really, really interesting, Ida, got an undergraduate degree, and then she got an MA, and then she got a law degree, and then she did everything except the dissertation for a PhD in economics from the University of South Carolina, all the while being married and having kids. And so you have this group of sisters who are teachers. So it's interesting because you have Blanche, who's married into this umpteenth Charleston family, and then her sisters who are teachers, and then Ida, who is blowing the top off the curriculum at the University of South Carolina, and they're still all cooking recipes and talking about the Old South.
Yeah. Ida was my favorite, too. I was hoping you were going to talk about her.
Well, and the University of South Carolina has some interesting stuff on Ida because she was number one in her law school class. And so there's some things commemorating her at the USC Law School, apparently.
Oh, very cool. I was also interested in Lise Dawson, who's a local restaurateur.
Yes.
Anybody else who stands out as interesting?
And I know very little about her. Lise apparently is a typical Charleston first name. I haven't seen it anyplace else, and I think it probably comes from a family name, but I'm not sure. She had this inn and restaurant called Villa Margarita, and it was quite elite, and the food was excellent. And it's one of those things where I wish I knew more about her. I was not able to find a great deal about her except that she ran this astonishing restaurant for several decades. So, you know, even with the internet and all that we have, there's still a lot of silences around women's mm-hmm. lives.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting to go to Charleston and see what could be known about her.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, well, of course, it's the house, the Villa Margarita was named for the house, which was built in the 1890s. It was not antebellum, but it was, it has a long, sultry story, shall we say, of its own.
So a cookbook introduction, especially one of these, is exceptionally short. So was there things that you learned about that maybe you didn't have time or room to write about here?
Well, I want to give a shout out to the USC Press because they actually did give me a few extra 100 words
to
talk about the thing we were just talking about, which are the clusters of the women who are in there. I think I probably could have done more with talking about the food itself. On the other hand, the recipes are there. What do they really need me to talk about? You know, there. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about the cookbook is that there are recipes that are distinctly Charlestonian. Things like shrimp and grit, that have Charlestonian backgrounds, like shrimp and grits, or I don't even know how to pronounce pilau, P-I-L-A-U, yeah. The rice dishes, those are quintessentially Charlestonian. So a discussion of the actual food itself. Now, I will give a shout out. There's a professor at the University of South Carolina named David Shields, and he does phenomenal work on the actual foods. And he and a South Carolina cook have a gorgeous, gorgeous book on South Carolina food that will be out, I believe, in October. So a shout out for that, to watch for David Shields' new book. And maybe
I'm going to call him. I'm going to get him on the pod.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. But they were kind enough to send me an e-edition to look at, and it is just phenomenal. It's by a chef named Kevin Mitchell and David Shields, called Taste the South, South Carolina's Signature Foods, Recipes, and Their Stories, and it'll be out in October.
Fantastic.
Gorgeous book, and I sent a message to several of my South Carolina friends. My BFF lives in Spartanburg, and said, "Hey, you want to put this on your list to give for Christmas presents?" Every South Carolinian's going to want a copy.
Oh, for sure.
So what else in terms of talking about the food? I think that, there's a lot to be written about the culinary history of Charleston itself, although David has done a good job of covering a lot of it in his work. But I can't emphasize how much Charleston was. It was a something in the antebellum period. And if Charlestonians seem overly impressed with their mythical past, it was, as Laurie Glover's book on Eliza Pinckney really depicts beautifully, it was an exceptional place of white privilege. It was, if you were going to be a privileged, rich, white Southerner, Charleston was a really good place to be. So more of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, with all these kind of critiques and caveats that you've noted throughout, what do you think is the biggest contribution of this book now? What can we still do with it or learn from it? Is it an oddity, or is it something useful, or what do you think we can do now?
Well, first of all, it's a cookbook. And one of the wonderful things about 20th century cookbooks is that for the most part, you can cook from them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You and I can take any one of these recipes in our 2021 kitchens, and we can produce these. The ingredients we recognize, thanks to the home economists at the New York newspaper, the measurements are all standardized. Some of them give temperatures and some don't. In the 1920s, early 1930s, most stoves had thermometers.
Mm-hmm.
They may not all have had thermostats. You know, where you just say, okay, I want 450, and you hit the button and it gives you 450. They may not have had that, but and it's not too hard. There are things on the internet. So if they stipulate a slow oven, you can look it up and figure out that probably means about 225 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
Quick oven, 400 to 450. But again, most of these recipes are from ingredients we recognize and processes that we recognize, and we can do this. So that's the thing I would do, is I would pick it up and I haven't, but if I were curious about it, I'd pick it up and I'd cook something out of it.
Sure.
And it would probably turn out just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we do with it culturally, I'm not sure, except to note, this is 5 years before Gone with the Wind.
Okay.
So I think it helps set the stage for that, which we are still in response to so much.
Yes.
So much. This lost cause, Southern Romanticism, this is squarely in that camp.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I think putting it in that timeline kind of helps to explain a little bit about what you were saying about Northern sensibilities and who the audience really is, right? It might not be that white Charlestonians needed this book, but it has this other audience. Yeah.
And white Charlestonians may have needed this book to make themselves feel better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Seriously. But the North... And again, you know, Keitelin Roberts and Yule and other authors are very good about nailing this of Northerners getting their jollies looking at the South.
Mm-hmm.
And, dare I say complicit?
Yeah. Well, the last words of your introduction are these: cook and enjoy these recipes, remembering the Black hands that made them possible. So talk a little bit more about that. So you want us to pick it up and use it. How do we do that? What are you imagining a reader could do that would be respectful, you know, without participating in the white supremacy work that was originally intended to be done by this book? What does that look like to you?
That's a good question. And I don't know that I really have an answer for it other than just be mindful.
It's an attitude.
It is an attitude. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
It really is an attitude of respect. Beautiful, abundant recipes carry cultural freight with them. And we cook them out of our abundance, and we share them with people we love out of our abundance and out of our love for those people. But, I mean, it's part of the conundrum. Compounds the conundrum of being human and consuming, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're mammals, we have to eat. But how we do it and how we think about it and the forms of thankfulness and gratitude and reciprocity that really should go along with our consumption of food really extend, I think, into these cultural realms.
Yeah, and I think something about storytelling. Which of the stories are you going to repeat when you serve this dish? The one that Blanche Rhett wrote in front of it, or the one that Dr. Sharpless explained in much better context?
Well, most people will prefer the Blanche Rhett. It's much prettier.
It is very poetic.
And it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
It's just easier unless you're Black.
Right. Exactly.
In my book that's coming out next year, there's a picture of a child with a disease called pellagra. Coincidentally, it's a child in South Carolina. It's just coincidence. Pellagra is a niacin deficiency disease that causes, the people are typically starving and they have skin problems and they have dementia, and it will eventually result in death. And it took a lot of work on part of nutritionists to figure out that it was from eating too much corn that it had the nutrients stripped out of it by industrial processing. But there's this photo of this child with its emaciated limbs and patchy skin, and I posted it on social media and said, bet they're not going to use this one for the cover.
Mm.
Because that's not what people want when they pick up a book about food most of the time. They want to read about the abundance, and they want to read about the love. And here I am poking holes in that at every chance I get along the way.
Yes, read my next book. That's what it's all about.
Sorry.
Well, I hope I finish writing it soon. That would be nice. I do want to ask you one more question to sort of speculate a little bit. I know that you were invited to write the introduction, so you didn't propose this project. So it might be speculation. But why do you think now? What is the occasion for a new edition? You kind of talked about it as not a round century marker. What do you think? Is it just that Charleston food is hot?
No idea. No idea. What I do know from Googling a little bit is that they had previously asked a very, very well-known South Carolina cook to write the introduction, and for whatever reason, she backed out. I've seen a mock-up of the cover with her name on it.
Mm.
And I think it would have been different. The introduction would have been quite different. And as I may have said at the beginning, when they contacted me, I was like, I'm a historian. I'm not a food writer. I don't make things pretty.
Right. Yeah, I wondered if it had, you know, there was the Top Chef season of Charleston was in 2017. Sean Brock, Rodney Scott, BJ Dennis. These are some kind of major Mike Latta, you know, big award-winning Charleston chefs. Mm-hmm. And it is quite a tourist destination even now.
It is.
For food, certainly.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, the last question. Two questions. And you talked about this earlier too. Are there other out-of-print historical cookbooks that need this kind of treatment? They need a scholarly critical introduction. I know how much I owe to Karen Hess, who's done this work with Amelia Simmons and Mary Randolph. And so now I'm asking for some homework here, Dr. Sharpless. What should we do next?
There are any number of cookbooks, of course. Of course, you know, the practical part of me says, a lot of these are available full text on the internet. They don't need to be reprinted. But there are, but if you're going to, it's a little awkward to cook from something in HathiTrust,
mm-hmm.
although it's certainly possible. It's very possible to get to those old texts. You mentioned Karen Hess. Her Martha Washington's Book of Cookery is an astonishing piece of work, and it will forever be my model of how a cookbook should be annotated and discussed. Her thoroughness was just, her thoroughness and her knowledge
mm-hmm.
were just irreproachable. So I don't know, and it would be interesting to talk to various presses. In this day of the internet, I wonder about the future of reprinted historic texts.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get to something for free on HathiTrust, are you going to buy a print book? Well, obviously, at least two of the presses that I am familiar with, South Carolina being one of them, have decided, yes, that they want to continue this. So that may be a question for the professional mm-hmm. press people as opposed to me. Are there cookbooks just lying there waiting? As a Southernist, again, props to the University of South Carolina Press. They reprinted the four antebellum Southern cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
Those Virginia Housewife, the South Carolina Housewife, the Kentucky Housewife, which is delightful. The writer was a woman named Lettuce Bryan, and I just wanted to go have supper at Lettuce Bryan's house. Her sense of humor and her practicality, I just really, really liked her. And then there's a fourth one written by a woman called The Lady of Charleston. And South Carolina has reprinted all of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been out, they've been in print for a good while, probably since the early 1980s. So maybe they need looking at again. But if the editor is, you mentioned, you know, if the editor is the quality of Karen Hess, they don't need to be redone because she covered it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there's something about that packaging of a critical introduction with the book that I think I still want as a consumer and as a scholar.
Well, and the annotations, particularly on the early ones, I've spent a fair amount of time looking at 17th century recipes, and there are things I do not have a clue what they are.
Yeah.
And without the work of people like Hess and Elizabeth David and others, I would be busy Googling because the vocabulary has changed. The ingredients have changed. For example, when's the last time you cooked anything with musk?
With musk? Never.
Yes, me neither. I'm not even sure I could find it if I needed it. So, yeah, if you want to cook with seasoning made from the glands of a deer, there you go.
So yeah.
Musk and ambergris and all those kind of animal-based spices that were typical among the elite in the 17th century. Without those editors and annotators, we would be lost.
For sure. Well, let's talk about your next project. You said it's coming out next year. Say a little bit about what that's going to be.
It is a book called Grain and Fire, A History of Baking in the American South. It's being published by the University of North Carolina Press and is slated to come out next May.
Oh, that's great.
It starts pre-contact and goes up to today, so it's kind of a baggy monster. But it looks at baking as a way that people make sense of their worlds. Really, until after the Civil War, baked goods were more a matter of sustenance than they were the sweets that we think about. People got a lot of their calories from grain, and particularly from bread. And so looks at all that and who ate what. The question of who ate corn and who ate wheat flour is throughout the book after the Europeans get here. Before that, it was a question of who ate red oak acorns, who ate white oak acorns, and who got to eat chestnuts.
Wow. Okay.
So, and of course, corn and more corn. The beautiful grain that it is. So it looks at grain. It looks at milling. It looks at recipes and baking and ingredients and relationships. And it was a lot of fun.
That's wonderful. Great. Well, I will absolutely be calling you for a copy of that and to talk about it again when it comes out in May. So Rebecca Sharpless is professor of history at Texas Christian University. We've been talking to her about the critical introduction to 200 years of Charleston cooking, out now from South Carolina University Press. Thank you so much for talking to me today. I loved catching up with you again from our old days at TCU. And thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you, Carrie. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for listening.